Hi, everybody. I'm Gordon, and I have the disease of alcoholism. Welcome. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, being remembering why we're here and for those who were here before us for the past 70 years. Again, I am Gordon. I have the disease of alcoholism. And I have tried to say that every day for the past 28 years. Because I need to be reminded that I have a fatal disease that's lurking there, ready to make itself clinically known at any time. I'm privileged to be the executive director of IDAA, and as a result of that, was asked by to sort of coordinate this meeting and the speakers and arrange for this doctor's panel, and it's a real privilege to be involved in it. It's a real privilege to do what I do today. And I'll announce it at the end of the program, but we invite all of you back over to the Royal York to the hospitality room for coffee afterwards if you'd like to join us. I know everybody's busy and got plans, but we'd like to see you there, and we have literature available about IDAA, our coming meeting in Palm Springs. An IDA membership is available to, it's been around for 60 years and is for all of those in the at the doctorate level in the healthcare professions. We have doctors, dentists, veterinarians, pharmacists, psychologists, a few sociologists, a few nurses, a few others that are at the doctorate level or pursuing doctorate level degrees. And we have an annual meeting. We'll have 12 to 1500 in California first week in August this summer. And it's a wonderful five-day retreat devoted to recovery for those of us in the healthcare professions. And we invite you all to be there to qualify. Or come, you can come as a guest. At any rate, enough of that. And the real thing we're here for is to hear our speakers. And we've got three world-class speakers lined up. They better be. They're lined up. Mel got here, by the way. Burns, I've known him for so many years that he's going to be late for his funeral, so I was glad to see him get in the door. I forgot who was supposed to go first. Was it on the program? However the program's listed. At any rate, Mel from Virginia. Ladies first.
Hey, everybody. I am I'm Mel. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the support of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since December 1st of 1986. And for that, I am extremely grateful. And there's a lady where I live now in Williamsburg who told me a year or two ago that a grateful alcoholic won't drink. And so what I try and say every day is that I am a grateful alcoholic. I think it's my job to stay grateful. And thank you for having me here. I wouldn't be here except for the fact that where I got raised in AA, which was in Cleveland, Ohio, they said, you don't say no in AA. And I was standing in my kitchen one night, and Gordy called up and said, will you come and talk at the International? And my brain was saying, no. And my AA heart was saying, of course, you have to say yes, you know. The only time I've ever said no in AA is when I was pregnant. And at the smokehouse where I lived in Statesboro, Georgia at that point in time, they still smoked in the building. And I was pregnant. So I said no, I'll talk to you another time. But that's, I think, the only time I know I've ever had to say no in AA. And actually, I don't really need to be up here because you guys heard my story last night. Between all the three folks that talked, the only thing that didn't apply is I haven't put any needles in my arm yet. So is that okay? Can I sit down? Okay. I'll tell you a little bit about me. Grew up, two kids, parents who are teachers, on Long Island in New York. So that's sort of where I really believe I'm a New Yorker inside. I'm a New Yorker and an alcoholic. You know, this is strange, and I bet you guys will get this. I was somewhere recently where, I should be paying attention to time, someone was asking, what are you proud of? And the thing that came into my mind was, I'm proud that I'm an alcoholic. For real. I mean, all inside, deep inside of me, that is what I am proud of. You know, and I was thinking, one of the greatest things that happened to me, and we haven't gotten to how bad it was, except that I told you what everyone said last night was true, you know, but when I found that there was this book that told everything about me and solved every problem that I have, it was the greatest thing. Like you said, the freedom, you know, because, you know, my alcoholism took freedom away from me. You know, I started out as a pretty good kid. You know, mainstream, center of the road, Pippi Longstocking, growing up. Nothing too dicey for me until I started drinking. You know, and there were a few things that started fueling my flame. You know, way back when. There was sugar and white flour when I was a kid, and then I went to college, and, you know, marijuana lit the way. It was like the miracle for me. It really was. I had a day where I tried that marijuana, and the whole world was just as silly and as funny and as happy as anything could be. And my brain said, what situation could you possibly be in that couldn't be made better by having this stuff around? And that's sort of exactly where I went. You know, and this is before, yeah, I was drinking. Yeah, my drinking wasn't exactly necessarily attractive or consistent with my value systems. You know, but even by the time I left college, it was... Well, this would be sort of how I could sit down and be in the world. Pink Floyd on the headphones, Pink Floyd, smoking bong hits, reading a book while I'm spooning scoop per bite of ice cream from a pint and a pack of Hostess chocolate-covered donuts. That was just kind of Mel sitting around trying to relax, you know. And you guys think that's normal, right? That's right, okay. So, you know, but what was already happening at that point was what I think Angie talked about last night, was I was starting to move away and get away and hide away, you know, and not be there anymore. I mean, I had started out college as the girl who had her weekly English paper written the week that it was assigned, even though it wasn't due till next week. You know, and by the end, I was doing the minimal possible to get by, putting things off, hiding, sitting in my room, doing what I just told you about. And then I went to medical school, which I usually don't get to say that, you know. And when I'm talking in AA, I'll just say I went to graduate school because partly, mostly, I don't really think I'm a doctor. And I have a friend, Dottie Lou Williams, who's always saying, Mel, you got to play the doctor card. Play the doctor card like it's going to get me stuff. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to play the doctor card. But certainly the last thing I want in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is anything that's going to separate me anymore from any of you guys, you know. But I, you guys know I'm a doctor, so I could say it. I went to medical school, and the drinking pretty quickly got to be every day. You know, I had this thing for a very long time back into my childhood, which was that I didn't fit in, you know, that I didn't belong. And now I had this other thing that was happening where I couldn't even be around you people and I didn't want to go. And that got to the point in medical school where I kept kind of not going. And I'd stay home and, you know, it wasn't enough anymore to just smoke pot. I had to drink, too. I had to drink to not feel the way I was, which was scared all the time. Scared you were going to figure out I was a fraud, that I didn't know what I was doing. Just scared, you know, 100 forms of fear. I don't even need to do a four-step anymore. I can just move right to fear. What's my part? And fear. Just, that's it. That's the way that goes for me. And, but I kept somehow falling sort of upwards in spite of not going. I kept waiting for someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, all right, you haven't really been coming very much. You're out of here, you know. But the problem was partly, not that the people in school had anything to do with that, I was on a Navy scholarship. And so when I made my way all the way through medical school, you know, drinking every day, feeling like I didn't know what was going on, not attending many things, they graduated me and I was a doctor, and now the Navy expected me to work as a doctor. You know, I couldn't just take my diploma and cruise on out of there. I needed to work as a doctor, and I was very convinced that I didn't know what I was doing and that being a doctor was the really wrong thing. But here I was a doctor, and this I had sort of figured out, what did we decide? It was a fifth, right? That size of the alcohol I was drinking was a fifth. Do they still have fifths? Are they liters now or whatever? But anyway, so I was drinking a fifth, and I basically figured out that if I only drank half the bottle, I might go into blackout. I probably would, but I could still wake up in the morning and get myself together and get on off to work. And every day at work, I was afraid that someone was going to be terribly hurt or someone was going to die or something awful was going to happen because I didn't know what I was doing. And it worked okay for a little while because I was a neuropsychiatry intern, and and I can't remember when I should just leave now because my partner's going to, like, slay me. But I think, you know, like, probably I was on psychiatry first and hopefully couldn't kill anyone there, and, you know, whatever. But finally I get to internal medicine, which is basically really sick people in the hospital. And not that psychiatric people aren't really sick. Because they are. And I was convinced something terrible was going to happen. And the problem was that I couldn't drink during the day, so I kind of had nothing but fear and fear and fear and fear all day long, plus not knowing what I was doing in my own mind and waiting for them to find out. And so I realized I couldn't be a doctor. I had to stop. And again, I was in the Navy, so I couldn't just sort of say, you know, excuse me, I'd rather not be a doctor anymore. Could I, you know, sail the ship? I don't know. They paid a lot of money to make me a doctor, and they had an expectation there. So I came up with a great idea. I figured if I couldn't, and I hate to say it, but this idea occurred to me again recently because I felt like I needed to get out of work. It was a bit too much, just one afternoon recently. But here was the idea 20 years ago, I guess. More than 20 years ago, was if I couldn't, you know, use my hands, because, you know, we have to start the IV and draw the blood and write the note and examine the patient and all this sort of thing. So if I could not use my hands, then I wouldn't be able to work as a doctor and they'd find some other job for me and that would be okay. But I am a doctor, so I knew that if I messed up my hands are very complicated. They have spaces and nerves and veins and all these things that go on there, that if you mess them up, they could be permanently messed up sort of forever. So I didn't want to do that. But the arm, on the other hand, has two simple bones in it, you know, on either side, and I realized that all I needed to do was break both of my arms. And certainly I would not be able to work as a doctor. I know, you're thinking this does make good sense. So I knew that if, you know, and what had happened was an extra intern came into our group. I don't know why. Usually there's, like, way too much work for everybody and you're staying up all night and all this other kind of stuff. But for some reason, this extra intern was coming into our little group, and so this was my jumping off point. I packed up all my stuff, I wrote all my notes on my patients, and I was, you know, going to disappear from the medicine ward. And I went home and I knew, you know, that if I drank too much, I might not break my arms, and so I needed to be careful. But certainly I needed to drink, of course, you know, you're not going to just do this stone cold sober. And in withdrawal, of course, which was always my condition if I wasn't drinking at that point. And I woke up the next morning and it was about 9:30, you know, there'd been no point in setting my alarm or anything, but I wasn't at work and I hadn't run my arms over with the car, so I quickly gathered myself together, didn't have anything else to drink, went down to the parking lot, got my car, put it on the top of the hill, ran around behind the car, started it rolling down the hill, laid my arms down. Down comes the car, rolled over my arms, and all of a sudden there was the part I hadn't thought through, which was, and then the car started going down the road, and there were all kinds of cars down the road, and what was I going to do about that? And my Chevy Chevette didn't really do anything. It barely bruised both of my forearms. So I had to come up with another plan after I caught the car, which fortunately didn't hit any other cars. So, and the plan I came up with wasn't much better than the plan I just told you, because it involved me pretty much disappearing for about 2 weeks. And my family didn't know where I was, and my friends didn't know where I was, and nobody knew where I was, and nobody knew what was wrong with me. They didn't know if I was in a diabetic coma in an alley, if I'd been raped, if I'd been killed, if I'd been abducted. Nobody knew anything about me. And I was so powerless, because that's what I heard last night. You know, I was so powerless that I couldn't even pick up a phone somewhere and just call someone in my family, my parents, my brother, my grandparents, and just say, I'm okay, I'm alive. You know, I couldn't even do that. All I could do was drink. You know, and of course at this point I'm drinking the jugs with the handle in them, half gallon or whatever that is. And basically, so now I can drink all day long because I'm not working. And I took off. I was in Norfolk, Virginia at the time, and I took off. Somehow I had this idea that I might end up, well, that I might need to go to a hospital. Now, you need to know that the only problem I believed I had was that I was a doctor. I'm not being funny. I'm telling you the truth. That's my problem was that I was a doctor. But somehow this other part of my brain thought I might need to go to a hospital. And being that I was in the psychiatry department, I probably didn't want to go to the Navy Hospital in Portsmouth, Virginia, where I was working, and so better to go to the Navy Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, where nobody would know me. Well, that did take 2 weeks, and some stuff happened there. Stuff like, first I came out of a blackout in some hotel. I had no idea to this day where it is in Washington, D.C. Drank a few days there. Thought I was out of money somehow. I had no idea how. Found my way to another place, a friendship house, which is kind of where, like, I don't know, people from out of the country might come and stay. God found me this place, basically, and put me there for another week or so. And one day I was convinced I had no more money, and I couldn't drink anymore, and so I didn't go out and buy any more alcohol. You know, and I was laying on the bed there, and funny stuff started happening. Like, I see a little something here, or see a little something there, and feel a little weird. And one day I got up to go to the bathroom, and there was this huge spider web in the door. I mean, taking up the whole door of the thing, like in a movie or something. And it never really got much worse than that. I think probably because by the next day I started drinking again. Oh, and I noticed other stuff. Like I noticed waking up with what looked like bloody vomit on me. And needing to take note that I should let the doctor know when I did get to the hospital that probably I had some internal bleeding, because they need to know about stuff like that. And placing a little trash can at the side of the bed in case I might actually be cognizant enough to use that. But ultimately came out of another black. Well, went into a movie. Went into the movie that, what's her name? Mary Tyler Moore was in, I think, with Donald Sutherland. This was 1983, in the fall of 1983. It's whatever that movie was. Never saw it, actually, because I went into a blackout. Came out of the blackout in the emergency room at the Navy Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, telling the psychiatrist I didn't want to kill myself or anybody else, and then helping the internal medicine doctor put the tube down my throat, you know, to check for that bleeding. And the next morning, I wake up in the hospital, and this intern herself comes up to me. She looked nervous and afraid. Because she has to tell me what's wrong with me. She probably thinks I know, actually, but, you know, I'm not on the medical ward because I'm a doctor. And she says, you're an alcoholic. And we're giving you some medicine for detox. She says, and we have a program here that maybe you'll get to go to. Yeah. Now, I'm pretty sure that if I had a heart attack, you know, they wouldn't have said, and we have in a coronary intensive care unit that you might get to go to. But, anyway. And I believed when she said I was alcoholic. Well, come on, I'm not stupid, I may not have known anything, but when you're drinking that much alcohol, you probably are alcoholic. So I didn't have a problem believing I was alcoholic. What I ended up having a problem with was believing I was powerless, and I need to wrap up pretty quickly, I think, in the next 5 minutes. So I'm going to tell you that, I just get 20 minutes, right?
25.
Oh, 25. So I went to treatment there, and they introduced me to AA, you know, took us around in the van and all that cool kind of stuff. But I was in the Navy, and it's fine to be alcoholic in the Navy, and we have great Navy treatment centers for alcoholism, but I was having some sort of a hearing problem, or maybe at that particular program they weren't discussing it at that time, but I certainly didn't talk about marijuana or LSD or cocaine or any of the other alcohol-like substances that, you know, I have been wont to enjoy or put into my body, whether I enjoyed them or not. And my brother came to visit me, and he brought me some pot, and I smoked pot basically most of the time that I was at the treatment center. And did a few other things that, as they say, don't make for good telling from the podium, so I won't. And did not leave, you know, sober. I drank on the last two weekend passes I had, and I was drinking all the way back down to Norfolk. But this really cool thing had happened. I had believed, last night someone was saying something about not knowing what the answer was, or not having a support. I not only didn't know what the answer was, I believed I didn't deserve to know what the answer was. You know, and this great freedom I had when I got back to work was at least I could say, I don't know. Oh, well, this person's in congestive heart failure. I would actually go to the resident, which this is actually how it's supposed to work, and say, well, it's congestive heart failure. I think this is what I might like to do, but is there something I'm not thinking of, you know? But I couldn't do that before. I thought I, like, had to know everything, and all I wanted to do was hide and not be around everybody and go home and drink. So I actually got to drink. That would have been Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, 83, 84, drinking on back down. By April of 84, I was in treatment again at the Navy Treatment Center down in Norfolk, and I got sober then. And a lot of really cool things happened. I was able to not drink a day at a time. I started to remember things that I'd been told in the morning, later in the afternoon. I was working. Yeah, that's pretty good. I was working on a fourth step and all this sort of stuff. But the thing was, I didn't really believe I was powerless over alcohol. Now, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that, and you wouldn't have been able to understand that then, but I know now that that's what the problem was, because my brother stopped by with some Molson's Golden, and do you not think the first thing I saw when I got off the plane and got in my rental car was the Molson's factory coming in here, you know? And if you go to Niagara Falls, I'm not a wino, but there's about 800 wineries between here and there. I can let you know that, too. So I drank the green bottle beer with my brother, and I continued to drink. And I got to the point when I lived in Cleveland, the Navy sent me on up there, that I was drinking essentially all the time unless I was actually at work. And when I woke up in the morning, my balance was so bad that I couldn't close my eyes to wash my hair in the shower. I would have to go to the kitchen sink, wash my hair, then go to the shower where I could keep my eyes open and kind of wash the rest of me, and put on my uniform and go on down to work. And as soon as work was over, come home and start drinking. And, you know, there's that special time of the year when 7 in the morning looks kind of the same as 7 o'clock at night or 7:30, so that if you come home from work pretty early and you start drinking and you black out and you wake back up again, you might think it's time to go to work. You might go to the kitchen sink, wash your hair, get in the shower, put your uniform on, and drive right on down to Cleveland, where no one's on the road. Because rush hour was 2 hours ago and no one's on the road. But you can still keep driving and get all the way down to the Federal Building, find a really good parking space, make your way up to the 26th floor where the clinic is, set off the alarm, and let yourself into the clinic. And I did do that, only on one occasion. And, you know, that's the kind of alcoholic I was at that point. But the kind of alcoholic I was isn't amusing like that. The kind of alcoholic I was is what they talked about last night. Alcohol was air and water to me. I could not be separated from it. I had to have it, you know, in order to live, in order to exist. I couldn't even come to you people, even when I knew. I am so powerless that God has to pick me up by the scruff of the neck and put me in a place to get sober. You know, I told you before I didn't know about you guys in the beginning, but obviously I knew about you after I'd been in treatment, and I didn't want to drink anymore. And the four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, their horses were breathing heavily down my neck every minute that I was awake during the day, except for the couple of minutes when I had poured enough alcohol into my body and was still awake and remembering that I couldn't feel anything. 5 minutes? Oh, 3 minutes. Okay. And so God wrought a miracle one more time, and they actually used marijuana, which got me kicked out of the Navy, which got the medical board of the state of Ohio to invite me for a visit. And all of these things were the ways that God brought me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. And I believed I was powerless down to the deepest fiber of my being. And I didn't want to drink anymore because I believed that the drinking was only causing more pain than it was solving, and I was willing to live without that. I had no strength to do anything, but God gave me that strength, and you people gave me. And I did what people talked about last night. You know, I stood at the doorway when they said, shake hands, stick your hand out and say you're male, you're an alcoholic. You know, go to women's meetings, go to step meetings, go to big book meetings, you know. And I couldn't tell you by the end of the sentence, when I read my little morning meditation, what the sentence had just said, but it didn't matter because I got up and I read my morning meditation and I said my prayers and I meditated. And they said things like, you know, you need to put as much effort into your sobriety as you put into your drinking. So if we had a snowstorm in Cleveland, Ohio, and I'd already been to a meeting, I would get in my car and go out and find an AA meeting because I knew that I would get in my car in the snowstorm to go out and buy alcohol. You know, and this program has brought me the most amazing life that I wish I had another 225 minutes to talk to you about. But since I don't, what I'm going to let you know is that my life is full of amazing bounty. The one thing I am most grateful about, because I know I am this powerless, is that I didn't have children when I was drinking, because I would have left my children like they were a pair of jeans, like we heard last night, to get alcohol, because that's the alcoholic that I am. And that is a great gift. And they're here with me. My son is talking right now in Alatine on principles and personalities. And none of them have ever seen me drink. But here's the thing. The second gentleman last night said that he went to a doctor who helped him find the place here. And for the girl who couldn't stand to be a doctor and who thought it was the most awful thing, I spend every day of my working life helping people that are interested become interested, even if they're not interested, in coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous if they would like to do that. And that is pretty big of a miracle. And the other thing from the guy last night is, before he even said it, I was sitting there saying, women, we've got to swarm Bombay. I'm ready to go. Come and get with me. Thank you very much for my sobriety, everybody.
Love you. Oh, what a great start. One of the real privileges that I've had in my journey is to go to the UK and attend the British Doctors and Dentists meeting held yearly at the first week in October, and have gotten to know one of the wonderful people who attend that meeting, and our next speaker, Alistair.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Alistair, and I'm an alcoholic. I have to tell you, I'm frightened. I've always been frightened. I'll tell you why I'm frightened. There are men and women in this room who nurtured me when I first came into these rooms, who looked after me, who loved me, and they seemed like gods to me. They all seemed taller than me, and bigger than me, and louder than me. And they put their arms around me, and they made me feel safe. And they promised me that one day I could have what they had. And I didn't for a minute believe it. And I want so much, finding myself amazingly up there, to do it right for them. I've got so much that I want to say, that if I said it all, we'd be here until next month. So I don't really know where to start. I'm not going to go right the way back to the beginning, because there was nothing terribly remarkable about my drinking. There was nothing terribly remarkable about the family I came from. But I started drinking in second year at medical school because I was frightened and lonely, and I discovered that when I drank, it made me feel big and strong and tall and attractive to women. and I was very frightened. Sorry. Yep, sorry about that. In second year at medical school, I discovered that when I drank, it made me feel big and strong. And I also discovered that when I drank, I started doing things that were unacceptable to me. I started using other people and I started telling lies. And I discovered that the only way I could cope with feeling bad about myself because of the way I behaved was to drink more. And things got very bad. I failed my exams. I repeated second year. I got even more frightened and lonely. At the end of that year, by some miracle, I passed my exams and got back into the sort of mainstream and swore I would put my act in order. And I did, a bit. Life went on. I got involved with a fellow medical student who took charge of me. A lady. And I let her mind me for a bit. I let her mind my drinking. And I thought life was okay. I went on, I passed my exams, I was reasonably successful. I decided that I was going to be a psychiatrist. I don't suppose I even knew then why I wanted to be a psychiatrist. I know today. I, like many doctors, believe that I am immune to the illnesses I treat in a magical sort of way. Anyway, we set off together to train as psychiatrists. And after a while, I discovered that she was getting bored with me and was more interested in other men. And my world fell apart about me, and I went straight back to my old friend, the bottle. And extraordinarily, as a trainee psychiatrist, I spent 3 weeks completely drunk the whole time in a psychiatric hospital looking after patients. And I'm not sure that anybody really noticed. And I don't know where it would have gone, but I was rescued by the ward sister of the ward I worked on. She was a lady who had 13 siblings. All but three of her siblings were alcoholic. I didn't know any of this at the time, but she was a lady who was very expert at minding alcoholics, and I handed my will and my life over to her for the next few years. And she did an excellent job minding me. And I thought that my drinking was under control. I thought it was under my control. It wasn't. I was successful. We moved to the south of England. We were married. In rapid succession, we were blessed with two daughters. And my world fell apart. Without the person who was minding my alcohol, and with my nose put out of joint because I was no longer the centre of her life, I reverted to the bottle. I didn't understand why I was doing it. I couldn't justify it. I just did it. Sorry. Is that better? Okay. I guess I'm a bit quiet because I'm probably still inside, in parts, ashamed of the way I behaved at that time. Anyway, I hit the bottle. My wife was bewildered and frightened and angry, and the more bewildered and frightened and angry she got, the more ashamed I got, and the more frightened I got, and the more I drank, and things went downhill fast. I got to be appointed a consultant, which is sort of the top of the career ladder in the UK. And two things happen when you get to be a consultant. You get paid a lot more money, and for the first time in my career, I had nobody watching what I was doing. And my drinking just exploded even worse. I knew that my behaviour was completely unacceptable. I knew that young fathers and young husbands didn't behave like this. I knew that doctors were not supposed to be drunk at work. But I couldn't for the life of me explain why I was behaving the way I was. I worked for a while in an alcoholism treatment unit at that time. I got on well with the patients there and thought I had a natural flair. For understanding them. Things got worse. I was successful professionally, but at home, things got worse. I met a fellow consultant who drank at lunchtime. That enabled me to drink at lunchtime. I don't know how long I was a constant daily drinker for, but it got crazier and crazier. And I would wake every morning at 7 a.m. or earlier, or come to, and I would look around to see where I was, whether I was dressed, whether I was in my own bed, whether I was lying naked in the garden. It happened. For several years, I had no recollection of ever retiring at night. And I would wake, come to in the early hours of the morning, and I would think, oh, God, not again. And I'd think, today I'm going to get my life in order. And I'll have to have a couple of drinks at lunchtime to stop my hand shaking. But after that, I'm going to stop. This is going to be the end of it. And every day the same thing would happen. I would have the first pint of beer and I'd feel a little bit better. I'd have the second pint of beer and I would think, I don't know what the hell you're worrying about. Any doctor of your standing and reputation with the difficult patients you have and the appalling wife and dreadful colleagues would take a drink. And then it would just go on to blackout at night. And a bit of me knew. And a bit of me didn't know. And I couldn't, wouldn't, didn't do anything about it. I knew I couldn't stop drinking any more than I could breathe underwater. And I knew I was going to die, and I didn't think there was anything at all I could do about it. And by a long string of extraordinary and amazing coincidences, I met a member of this fellowship who I was supervising in his work as a psychotherapist, who was a clergyman. And he 12-stepped me by letter, ever so gently. And one day, in early 1988, having gone out to post letters one at a time because I never had a dog and needed excuses to go out, I came back to the house and it was empty. My wife and the two children had gone, and I knew why. And I found my friend's letter in my pocket and, drunk, started phoning round treatment centres that he had listed, and ended up drunk, having spoken to a man who was a friend of the family and an advisor, an eminent psychiatrist, and who I had not intended this to happen. I booked myself into a treatment centre. And on the 29th of February 1988, I found myself in a treatment centre in Weston-super-Mare in the south of England, with no real idea of how I got there. No real idea that this was going to involve stopping drinking. Just grateful to go anywhere to get away. I was there 2 days when I discovered that it involved stopping drinking forever, and I was there a week when my then therapist said to me, you'll have to go to AA for the rest of your life, and I thought that was awful. But I looked around the treatment centre, and I thought what was going on there was wonderful. I thought, this is just what these people need. I was very impressed. I did not for a moment, not a moment, think this would work for me, because I knew I was incapable of stopping drinking. And I knew the best I could hope for would be that I could crawl into a corner somewhere and die without too many people noticing. And by God, they'd be sorry after I was dead. I liked it in the treatment centre. The people there were awfully nice to me. The other patients were wonderful to me. They took one look at me and they said, you'd better come with us, Doc, because you won't last 5 minutes in here otherwise. Just do what we do. And I did. And I was looked after by 17-year-old street junkies, because I would not mix with those miserable, boring, middle-aged alcoholics. After 7 weeks, they let me out. I still didn't think it would work. I went home. I went back to work the next day. The first patient I saw was a man who had been a patient of mine for a long time. He was a chronic schizophrenic who believed he was being persecuted by the Freemasons. He had no insight. And he sat down in front of me and he said, you're back then? I said, yes. He said, do you mind me asking, have you been away being dried out? I'd known this man a long time. I said, yes, I was. And there was a long pause. And then this man, who had no insight into his chronic illness, quietly said to me, he said, you know, you're very lucky. There's something you can do about your illness. He died in a fire in his garage a year later. I have to tell you that all my patients were as kind and generous and wonderful to me as that man. I'd be told to go to AA, so I went to AA. I went not because I thought it would work, but because I didn't want anybody to point a finger at me and say that I was too proud or too frightened to go to AA. I went to AA in my hometown and was welcomed into AA by my own patients, some of whom I know today had no great reason to be pleased to see me. And I was still so crazy and so arrogant that I thought it necessary to explain to them that I was there for me and not for their benefit. and they showed me a chair they had been keeping for some years for me. And get this, last night I was in the Rogers Stadium. There are times when I like to just be alone in the crowd and be part of what's going on. And I was in the Rogers Stadium early because I wanted a little bit of space to myself, just to be a part of what was going on. And I sat down in an almost empty bit of the stadium, by myself, and pondered that there had been a time in my life when if I'd been by myself in a crowd that size, I'd have been full of self-pity and resentment and God knows what. And I was quite happy just to be a part of what was there. And I looked to my left after a while, as the stadium had filled up, and there was a man sitting about three seats down from me, and he said, "Hello, Alistair." And I didn't recognise him. So I moved along to sit next to him. He was at that first meeting that I went to. Nearly 60,000 people, and we end up sitting next to each other. Isn't that amazing? I was a year in AA. No, I was 9 months in AA, without a drink, still absolutely bewildered, didn't know what was happening, couldn't understand why I wasn't drinking. My marriage was falling apart, and that was not part of my fairy tale that I expected to happen. I thought at least if I wasn't drinking, my marriage would survive. And it was the darkest, most miserable time I've ever had in my life. I was terrified. I was terrified I would drink. I was terrified I was going to murder the woman I was married to. I mean that quite seriously. I had a terrible temper sober that I had never known when I was drinking, because I controlled all my feelings with alcohol. And I really was terrified I would kill her. And eventually I was advised to move out of the family home. And that wasn't part of what I'd planned. I can to this day remember the look on my two daughters' faces. They were 8 and 9, sitting in McDonald's. I guess that's where it always happens. Telling them that I was leaving home. In particular, I can remember the crumpled look on my younger daughter's face. This was not the way I had planned it to be. And for the second time, I thought this was the end of my life. The first time was when I'd gone into the treatment centre. The only friends I had left were in AA, and by now I had quite a few, and I threw myself into AA. I considered that my career as a doctor was probably over, even though I was still going to work. I didn't go to the British Doctors and Dentists group for the first 9 months because I was too ashamed to be seen by another doctor. I threw myself into AA. I was doing AA 7 days a week because it was all I knew. I went to work and I went to AA. And miraculously, things started getting better. I did go to the British Doctors and Dentists group. I met other doctors who told me that I didn't have to be ashamed of being an alcoholic doctor. And they showed me that I didn't have to be ashamed of being an alcoholic doctor. And I said to them that I thought I should give up being a doctor. And they said, "You did it long enough drunk. Why do you want to give up now that you're sober? You've got the timing all wrong." For 10 years, I was too ashamed to go to a meeting of the British Royal College of Psychiatrists because I thought my fellow psychiatrists would reject me. And some of them do. The reality is that I have colleagues who behave towards me as though this illness was infectious. I have others who are wonderful. And this year, for the second time, I addressed the annual general meeting of the British Royal College of Psychiatrists. And this year, although they didn't know they were doing it, they gave me the chance to tell them their story, which I did. I didn't think that I would ever want... When I was drinking, being a psychiatrist, being a doctor, was the only bit of my life that mattered to me. I wore a three-piece dark pinstripe suit. I looked the part on the outside. And the only identity I had was Dr. Alistair Young, the psychiatrist. And I thought, if I lose that, I will be nothing. In recovery, I discovered a new identity, which is my name's Alistair and I'm an alcoholic, and it's the best identity I've ever had. And for a time, I really didn't want to be a psychiatrist anymore, and I didn't want to be a doctor anymore. But over the years, things have changed. I work in the addiction field now. Two people, before this meeting started, walked up to me and said hello and introduced themselves and told me that I had played a small part in their recovery, and I wouldn't have known who they were if they hadn't told me. And that, too, is extraordinary. I can remember lots of things. I'm today married. I thought when my marriage broke up that no decent woman would ever look at me again. I thought that the best I could ever hope for was a series of one-night stands. I didn't think I would ever, I wasn't at all sure that I was capable of sustaining an enduring intimate relationship, and I am today happily married. My wife can't be with me because she is, as we speak, sitting beside her dying mother. But she insisted that I be here because her mother's unconscious and wouldn't know, and as far as she, Vicky, was concerned, she wanted me here because that was more important than being with her at this moment. And I accept her choice on that, because it is terribly important for me to be here. I can remember the moment when I realised that I had actually been clean and sober for a greater part of my children's lives than I was drunk. And that seemed a triumph. I have a terrific relationship with my children today. They're both grown up young women, which is extraordinary. I was always frightened of my parents. My daughters are not frightened of me. They've both done extremely well. They're both well aware that they carry a bunch of genes that may make them vulnerable to these illnesses, and they both know what to do about it. And they regularly ring me up at 2 o'clock in the morning to know what to do with their drunken and drugged friends. And I'm immensely proud of the fact that they do that. And I think it's wonderful that one good thing that comes out of this for them, no, there are several good things. They've got a father which they never had before, because to tell you the truth, before I drank, I was so frightened and lonely and self-centered that I didn't know how to be a father. This fellowship and the people in this room have taught me how to be a father, taught me how to be a husband, taught me how to be a doctor, taught me how to be a psychiatrist, taught me how to be a human being, because I didn't know. Through this fellowship, I've rejoined the human race. I rang Melbourne last night. My younger daughter, Kirsty, having done 2 degrees, has taken a year out to go around the world. And I've known for a year or so that she's been in trouble, because from time to time she would ring me up and she'd say, "Dad, you know all this AA business and everything. Can I talk to you? I'm not going to tell you what the problem is, but I need to talk to you." And we've talked. There have been long conversations. Sometimes, I remember on one occasion, it was in the middle of an academic convention when she phoned me, and I was hanging out a window on the end of a mobile phone. But I've known that she had some sort of compulsive self-destructive disorder, because of when we talked to each other, I knew that there was something going on, precisely what I didn't know. And she wasn't prepared to give me all the details, and I didn't ask for them. She just wanted the benefit of my experience, strength, and hope. And then earlier this year, she rang me up from Melbourne to tell me that she had just attended her second 12-step meeting, that she was a compulsive overeater, and how grateful she was for my example. I rang her last night in Melbourne to get her permission to share this with you. And she said, "Of course you can share it. It's part of your story as well." And actually, hell, I'm a psychiatrist. I'm much better at managing your feelings than mine. I never expected recovery. I never wanted it. I didn't think I need it. It has been wonderful, beyond my wildest, wildest dreams, and it's still getting better. I'm just going to stop there. I really am so grateful for everything that has been given to me, and if I can give even a small part of it back, that will be even more wonderful. Thank you.
Truly is a universal program. Thank you, Alice, there. That shakiness in the morning kind of reminded me, as the chief of surgery in a hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, 30 years ago, after a particularly bad weekend, I got called in on I didn't operate on Mondays for a particular reason, and I got called in on an emergency, and somehow my hands weren't working too well, and I knew the problem was all that damn coffee I was drinking. I was so convincing, the nurses bought me a pot of tea, so I didn't have to drink coffee anymore. Shaky, shaky. again, one of the privileges of this great program is getting to know people and the personal friendships that we establish. Last night, sitting in front of me was our next speaker, Burns B. from Kentucky. And we go back 25 years working together on the physician's program in Kentucky, which I had to resign from when I took this job as for IDAA because I didn't want to have to report anybody that might be calling me, and there's kind of a conflict of interest there. So I don't work with them anymore, but we do see one another, and a wonderful, wonderful friend. And we were privileged in 1986 or 7 to have the IDAA meeting in Lexington. And I'm reminded of this because of that Amazing Grace song last night. And Burns was sitting in front of me. I just never will forget. After our IDA meeting back there in 97, at the conclusion of this meeting, this wonderful gathering we'd had for days, we had an old black guy who sang the Lord's Prayer. And when he said, "Thy will be done," Burns and I just started crying together.
Yeah, Gordy and I have been crying together for a long time. We really have a lot of it over spirituality and some of it over golf, but we've been crying together a long time. And when you get golf and spirituality together, it really does a hell of a job. My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody, I'm really grateful to be asked to be here and to do this. Last night was a very special night. This is the first international that I've ever attended, and obviously Casey's ever attended. And it was a long time before I realized why I didn't come. And it was because I was scared. I was really scared to come, scared to see that many people. I just didn't know what it was about it, but it really frightened me. And that's getting better using the tools that we've learned to use. But last night, I realized that what has been one of the major payoffs in this program is I was sitting with some people that I would have never met, certainly Graham and Dick, and we were literally crying, as all of you were, I'm sure. And then when we walked out in the hall, we got in a huddle and just put our arms around each other and cried out in the hallway. That's very special stuff. And tonight, I will be with a bunch of Kentucky people, and we'll do the same thing. We will do the same thing. And I realized that I wanted to spend Friday night with the group that has been so much to me, the Docs, and I wanted to spend Saturday night with a group that's been so much to me, the Kentucky people. And that's what this program has been all about. I listened to Mel, who I absolutely adore, and I realized that her problem probably is alcoholism, but she makes bad decisions about cars to buy. She bought two little cars. I mean, hell, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that ain't going to work with a Chevette, for God's sake. And I just was kind of intrigued by Alistair's story. I never had a garden, but if I did, I don't think I'd lay naked in my garden, for God's sake. Maybe the Days Inn Motel, but not that. Probably in the parking lot trying to figure out whether I was going in or coming out. Wouldn't have anything to check to see if I could figure that out either. For me to be in front of a group of professionals, the years have been kind. I've had an opportunity to do that, but for some reason this is a very special thing for me today, and it seems pretty obvious why it would be. But God, the mosaic of God's process in my life is intriguing to me. It fascinates me. Now, obviously, I'm deeply grateful for it, but I'm 69 years old, and I'm having a chance to look back and see the whole evolution of my life. And seeing it from where I look at it today, I really do see the hand of God virtually in my life ever since the moment I was born. And where that has led me to be today, in the most unlikely of circumstances, that number one, I'd ever be a doctor, number two, that I'd be alive, and number three, that I'd be a sober doctor with a number of years of recovery, being a beacon for a lot of people, as there were beacons for me. In AA, we not only condone heroes, at least my experience has been, we promote them. And they're called sponsors and winners. And it was a while before I could be in that position because I had to fit myself or to be trained to do it. Unfortunately, I went out on my own for a lot of times, but it didn't seem to screw too many people up, you know, because I got a great sense of humor, and when I didn't say shit, at least it was funny. And I got promoted to go out and do stand-up comedy on the Sawdust Trail in AA, and that was okay. I listened to some of those tapes. They're amusing to me, But they never hurt anybody because I really had a good heart. The home I came out of was... the home I came out of... You damn well bet I want you to hear me. That's when I got this thing out here. And it may not be what you're going to hear. I just about got, don't want anybody to walk out here and not hear what I got to say, you understand? This is my last shot at this kind of thing, and I want to be damn sure it's good. Yeah. But I grew up in a home where the idea of my even going to college was remote. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college. The idea of being a doctor was even more remote. The idea of being a drunk was pretty much self-assured. I got a gene pool that doesn't run very deep, but it runs a long way, I got to tell you that. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail in 1935. My mother was raised in that home, molested, the whole deal. She was a true adult child. And some regular AA meetings, people have a problem with that concept. Just read the first page of the family afterward, and it said, when you're around one of us, you get neurotic. And I adored my mother. Died in 78, and I adored her. Still adore her. Think about her every day, but she was a goofy lady. Full of a lot of love and compassion. I'm pretty much modeled after her. I know what that lady's heart was, but she was really scarred with the shame and all that came through that. And it dominated our home. Most of the theme of my life has been a theme of drive for perfection, for the need for approval. And when I read Bill Wilson's Emotional Sobriety that he wrote in 53, it was published in 58, the Grapevine, he started talking about it in 53. And for me, it was the second best thing he ever wrote after the Big Book. And he talks about that all his problems were money, power, prestige, sex, distilled into approval. And my entire life has been driven by the need for approval and the absolute fantasy of trying to be perfect to get that approval. And it is still right behind my eyes. It is there. It dominates me in a heartbeat. This need for approval and the drive for perfection. This program was the first place, and it took me a long time to get this program, not about drinking, not about where I was home, but the idea of putting into place some game plan where I would not have to be perfect every damn day, because it goes clean to the mirror of me, is the need for perfection. This program taught me not only do I not have to be perfect, you'll give me the tools to deal with the fact that I'll never be perfect. And on a daily basis, I get a chance to deal with the demons that dominate me. I thought they'd go away. They are better. But on a daily basis, I've been given all the tools I need to deal with those demons. And for anyone who's ever played golf with me, you damn well know I'm driven by demons. I mean, honest to God, the game of golf plays out in my life. It is not a game. It is my frigging life. Every putt is a need for perfection. Every ball is a need for perfection. Everything is a need for perfection.
It ain't no good.
That's exactly right. I don't have any problem with that. There's a fantasy in my head that I once was, but even that was a fantasy. But this whole need for perfection dominated my life. And, you know, when Wilson in the fifth chapter and four steps said we go back through our lives, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty, he's basically at least inviting me, if not everybody else, to go back and work this process to deal with those demons, not the least of which is the self-centered fear and the need for perfection. I got it from my mother and daddy. I got it from the church. Doesn't mean I don't believe in the church. I don't have time to tell you my relationship with the church, but it's very profound, very deep, and very contributory to my life, and was extremely important in the first 8 years of my sobriety. And my mother and daddy, my God, I miss them every day, and they love me so much I can't tell you how much they love me. Now, fact is they created a monster between the need for perfection and the need for approval, which I got. I became Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy. When I laid in the bed the night before I went to college, I remember looking up at the ceiling and thinking, God, if I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me. Now, I got to tell you, that wasn't an arrogant statement. I was that good a kid. Now, the reason for being that good a kid was flawed, but I was that good a kid. And that was to be the rest of my life. Alcohol and drugs, no problem for me in high school, no problem for me in college. Of course, I drank. Of course, I did some silly things, but it was no problem. I started medical school in 1958 at the University of Louisville. About a month into medical school, studying for the first gross anatomy exam. Somebody came up and gave me an amphetamine because I couldn't stay awake to study, and I took that amphetamine and the world opened up. I mean, I had found a whole new way of life. Now, there are parts of my story, I've listened to a lot of fifth steps over the years, and each time I listen to one, almost invariably, if we follow the diagram, they're pretty much going to be a lot the same, because that's the way it's structured to be, to look at the seminal demons that Wilson and God distilled into the things that were still into self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. But each time I've listened to one, I see a piece, and I think that piece is what God wants this individual to share somewhere. And my story is no different, because I took amphetamines for 8 years with no alcohol. I drank alcohol for 8 years, took amphetamine for 12 years with no alcohol. I drank alcohol for 8 years with no amphetamine, and they both did the same. They just destroyed me. Which tells you that for an alcoholic of my type, I will not process mood-altering medication the same way. Which tells us what we all know from the textbooks, but this is my experience, validating what the textbooks are now teaching us. There are other parts of my story are that I know are very personal to me, and I'll go through those. When I started taking amphetamine, the world changed. Everybody else in medical school took amphetamine to study. Everybody else quit. I didn't. 2 weeks before graduation, in an amphetamine rage, I slapped one of my professors. They thought that was poor form. Hell, I thought it was poor form. They took me to the dean, and the dean sat with the head of the Department of Psychiatry. They told me I needed to go get help for my drug problem. I was in intensive psychiatric therapy for 2 years, saw two psychiatrists a week. Quit taking amphetamine. The last year and a half, I sat with all my books and all my notes and reviewed everything. I was ready to go back into medical school. I wasn't even thinking of taking amphetamine. Walked back into old Louisville General Hospital, and in less than an hour, I was strung out on amphetamine. I didn't even realize it. Cocaine taught us a lot, as you know. It taught us a lot about euphoric recall. It taught us a lot about cueing and things like that. And for me, the drugs were a slam dunk cue. Alcohol has been kind of a subtle cue to seduce me. Amphetamine wasn't subtle. It was an ass kicker. So I walked back into medical school, ready to go, and in less than an hour, I strung out on amphetamine, just sat there and cried, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. Psychiatry really helped me. Psychiatry brought me some information like anger is not a primary feeling. Anger is a result of resentment and fear. They taught me that in 1962. I didn't get to y'all until 1977, but y'all taught me the same thing. What psychiatry didn't bring me was a spiritual solution. They brought me knowledge. And we know what the book says about that. I'm a firm believer in therapy. I'm a firm believer in therapy, at least for me, to help me know where the bullets are coming from. The spiritual solution helps me deal with the bullets. But I kept getting hit, even in recovery, and made some really lousy decisions about relationships and things like that, because I never knew where the bullets were coming from. I never knew that what you do with a woman is you give her everything she wants, and then she'll take care of you and make you feel special. Because that's what I learned from Mama. That's what I learned from Mama. And I thought, you know, if you do that, that's the way it'll work. Well, hell, I ran into a lot of crazy women. And, man, I just took care of, beat hell out of them, and they never did give me back what, they never took care of me and made me feel special. So it was their problem, not mine. I even ran into a couple of healthy women. They didn't stay for about 15 minutes, but they, that's just the way it was. Got back in medical school, got on amphetamine, classmates enabled me, graduated in 1964, went to my internship and residency, interrupted by putting me in mental hospitals 4 times, strapped down, IV fluids, straitjackets, padded cells. My stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. I always went back, always put me in. Tolerance had occurred, brain resetting had occurred, taking huge amounts, knocking me right off the wall. And they were doing the best they could do. 6 and 8 weeks at a time, I'd stay in the mental hospital in Louisville. Got mad at the Vietnam War and joined. I was in an amphetamine rage in a doctor's lounge one day bitching about the Vietnam War, and somebody said, quit bitching, join. So I joined. I went out and drove to Frankfort and joined the Army. Didn't tell my wife, didn't call my office, just joined the Army. I mean, they told me I had an impulse disorder, right? I've never seen any decent, self-respecting drunk didn't have an impulse disorder, for God. I mean, our credo is load, shoot, and aim in that fashion, you know? And my credo is if it smells good or drives fast, buy it or jump it, whatever you need to do. And, I mean, I still have these demons. no surprise to any of y'all, you know. I still have these demons. The great gift is I've been given the responsibility and opportunity to deal with them on a daily basis. And I mean, that's it, responsibility and the tools to deal with it. I almost got put in Leavenworth in the Army. Post commander came down and said, if you don't quit taking amphetamine, we'll put you in Leavenworth. So once he explained it to me, I quit. Came home in 1969, had the gallbladder taken out, and the surgeon and the internist and I sat and held hands and prayed that I'd quit taking amphetamine. And I did. That was my last amphetamine. The prayers had a lot to do with it. And as I get a chance to look back and see that mosaic of the hand of God in my life that I choose to believe is there because I can see the pattern. Most miracles are circles for me. And unfortunately or fortunately, I just get in on the first part of the circle. And in some instances, I have had a chance to see the circle close. And I think, my God, this started here. That made no sense. But in this total mosaic, it makes total sense. This was where I was being led and given the opportunity to discern. And that's exactly where I am today. Thank God I've been at it long enough. I make better decisions about discernment than I used to. In other words, the discernment of what is God's will. I'm sure the prayers had a lot to do with it, but what obviously worked right then was I started drinking. And I drank for 8 years. Last year, my drinking, first 7 years, my drinking wasn't alcoholic. Well, after the first 4 years, the middle third was, but it still didn't screw up my life. And the last year was addictive. I drank a quart of whiskey a night and told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. My first wife kicked me out of the house in 1975. Should have kicked me out sooner. Hell, we never should have gotten married. This is a mean woman. I was a goofy guy. And we just met together just like that. And I mean, we tried to make chicken salad out of chicken crap for 17 years, and it just wasn't going to work. I mean, it just wasn't going to work. But I was driven by this whatever. Multiple years of therapy, and it never was going to work. I didn't intend for it to work. I didn't know that. I was just playing out the string until the marriage was over. And finally, I embarrassed her enough. Didn't run around. But I embarrassed her enough with just my attitude. She kicked me out of the house. Womanized for 2 years, met Casey, probably the greatest individual on the face of God's earth. Wonderful heart. I had a good heart. Her daddy was bipolar. She watched her mother take care of her daddy. So she took care of me. I took care of her. And we started this wonderful relationship. I got terribly sick. And she's younger than I am. And even though women are affected much more severely physically than men, and we know that by alcohol. We know why. It didn't get her. She's an alcoholic by her own decision, and I agree with that. But I got real sick, sat with a 12-gauge shotgun in my mouth, didn't pull the trigger because I thought of my children. Figured Casey'd be better off without me, mother and dad'd be better off without me, my patients'd be better off without me. And at the moment of clarity, the moment of decision, I asked God to tell me what I needed to do to get the 12-gauge shotgun out of my mouth. Did he want me to pull the trigger? And I heard real clearly in my mind, you can't do your children that way. At that moment of complete self-absorption, which is what suicide is for me, is that moment of complete self-absorption where I believed in God, didn't know how to bring the power into me, did not know how to access God's power. And it's still difficult for me. I have to go through the whole drill on a daily basis, third step prayer, seventh step prayer, 11th step prayer, each day to begin the day, live the day, end the day, to be able to bring God's power into me. Because by very instinct and survival skills, I take the power to run my life and have a difficult time discerning between God's power and my responsibility. And most alcoholics I've ever worked with have that problem, especially when our survival skills kept us alive for as long as they did. The greatest deterrent to spiritual growth for me are my survival skills because they kept me alive. The very things that I used when I was drinking kept me alive. And when I came in this program, basically the whole idea was I had to give up the survival skills because they were self-centered and go to the spiritual skills because my value about what was life has changed entirely. My value about what is death has changed virtually entirely. But I pulled the shotgun out of my mouth, and at that moment of complete self-absorption, I thought of another human being. And Gordy talked about it early on. Each of the speakers has. Our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service. There's a thin line between the codependency that virtually all doctors have, that I've seen, drunk or sober. The codependency to be put into an interdependency to be able to carry a message to each of us. And to take care of people that are our responsibility and our vocation and our love. I've never seen an alcoholic doctor who does not eat up with shame and codependency. And how to shift that into a constructive tool has been what my life's been about. It's there. I take care of people now just like I took care of people before. Most of the time, my motive is entirely different. Most of the time, my motive is entirely different. sent me to treatment, came home, got into AA. The first 10 years of my life in AA were not big book and step oriented. This is a unique part of my program, and I tell it with great glee and with great joy because it is my experience. I spent 10 years in the program on a 3 1/3 step. The marching order was don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. So I lived for 10 years on a 3 1/3 step. And at the end of that time, I was absolutely destroyed. Didn't drink. Got into a 12-step program using Joe and Charlie's tapes, and now I have a full 12-step program. Spiritual solution is basically as a result of these steps. I've come to know that I've been blessed, as Dowling told Wilson, with divine dissatisfaction. My whole life is basically commandeered by a need to help, at the same time to deal with the demons that virtually are all over me. I've never known peace except when I'm talking with a drunk. I have known happiness, and I'm willing to be there. In the last 6 months, I have felt some things I've never felt. They're fascinating to me. They're a little scary. But I am beginning to feel something that I never thought I'd ever feel. I don't even know how to articulate it. Maybe never will. But I do know that what I identify as what I'm feeling is the peace of God that is coming into my heart after years of dealing with the things that started way back in my childhood. Drive for perfection, self-centered fear, and my own power. And gradually, through a lot of reasons and a lot of things, I'm feeling the peace and the presence of God. This journey is not a journey of perfection. I hope you find what I have found, and I hope I continue to find what most of y'all have found. I love you very much. Thank you.
Wonderful conclusion with our three speakers. Once again, I did want to invite all of you over to the hospitality room. That can make it over there at the Royal York. Take a while to get over there, but we've ordered some coffee and like to get to know any of you who we don't know, and all of those that we do. In the territories room of the Royal York, it's on the mezzanine level, and we're headed over there now. And it's called the room, Professionals in AA Room. It's right at the top of the escalator on the mezzanine floor. So, thank everybody for coming, and we'll close with the Serenity Prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom.